This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Children with mental illness are spending more time each year in emergency rooms, often waiting days for care that they don't end up getting. Often these kids are being monitored for safety precautions and then released with referrals to places to seek help elsewhere. Here's the thing, though. There aren't as many places for them to go as there once were. Hospitals are seeing repeat visits from families who are unable to find facilities in their communities and are in need of help. In 2010, only 40 children spent two or more nights in the ER in the state. By the end of this year, the number is expected to hit 500, according to Lisa Chetical's report for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team. Today, Where We Live, we'll look at the emergency room as a way to help kids with mental health issues, and we want you to join the conversation. Have you sought mental health services for your child only to end up at the ER? You can call 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We have a panel of guests in studio, but first I want to turn to Lisa Chetical, who's senior writer and co-founder of the Connecticut Health Investigative Team, who brought this issue to our attention with a report from a few weeks back. Lisa, welcome back to our show.
Well, thanks, John.
I'm wondering, first of all, you can just lay out some of the main findings. You took a look at specifically one Connecticut hospital, Connecticut Children's Medical Center. What did you find about ER wait times?
I actually found something that was very surprising. I looked more at lengths of stay in the ER. I knew that the numbers had gone up with kids with mental health problems because they had gone up nationally, part of a trend that officials are attributing to greater awareness around mental health and schools with a zero tolerance policy referring more kids. But what I found that was really surprising was that the number of multiple night stays, meaning two or more nights, pretty much skyrocketed at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. In 2010, only 40 kids spent multiple nights in the ER for mental health issues. And this year, the projection is 500 kids will spend multiple nights. And that's in some cases two nights. In some cases, according to the hospital, it's 2 weeks in an ER. So those numbers were sort of the basis for my story.
And we're going to have someone from Connecticut Children's Medical Center in just a moment to talk a bit more about the details. But maybe you can explain from your reporting, Lisa, why it was these children were coming to the ER in the first place. What was it that they needed help with?
These are usually, John, kids who are in crisis, some kind of crisis, where a family or a school or another caregiver will basically see a kid maybe threatening self-harm or threatening harm to others or just sort of melting down. So it's not a case where a kid's just walking around a little bit depressed or off for a day. These are kids in clear mental health crisis who are referred in. What the hospital folks say is that there just are not enough treatment slots or other community services for them, so that the ERs are taking the biggest hit with these kids. Schools are referring them to ERs, and guardians and parents are referring them at higher rates. But the sort of interesting piece to me was how they're not moving through the ER. I mean, you call with a kid in crisis, you go to the ER, you get checked, and one would assume you get referred out to an actual treatment provider. But at Connecticut Children's, literally, these kids are just sort of warehoused in the ER for days or weeks because of what hospital officials say is a critical shortage of outpatient or inpatient treatment slots. So it's the kid in mental health crisis who ends up in the ER. It's not a kid who's just depressed or having a bad day.
Now, this isn't just happening at this one hospital that you looked at. You took a look at Yale New Haven Hospital. They've seen a big increase in visits to the ER. The same thing's happening in emergency departments around the state, near as you can tell, Lisa.
Yes. Yep. New Haven, Bridgeport. I focused on Connecticut Children's because they keep an accurate count, but Yale New Haven also has seen a 10% to 15% increase. The problem at Children's, John, is they don't have any pediatric psychiatric beds in the hospital. Yale New Haven does have, I think, 36 beds, so that when a kid shows up at the ER in crisis at Yale, usually they can move them into a bed and start treatment right away. At Connecticut Children's, they don't have beds and they don't have clinicians who are trained in pediatric psychiatric services. So because they have Children's in their name, they get a lot of kids from pretty much the entire, you know, the entire state, concentrated around Hartford, obviously. But they can't move those kids into a bed in their own hospital, or even, in most cases, begin treatment because they just don't have the clinicians. So. It's a big problem.
And I'm going to ask you to hold for just a second because I want to bring in somebody from Connecticut Children's Medical Center. Lynn Mangini works as a child psychiatrist at Connecticut Children's Medical Center, which is, of course, affiliated with Hartford Hospital and the Institute of Living. And we've talked about mental health issues with many of the professionals there in the past. And Lynn, I welcome you to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Obviously, as we read this report, long ER stays for kids in crisis on the rise by Lisa Chetical, we're talking about numbers, including numbers provided by your hospital primarily. I'm wondering first if you can comment a bit on what you think is happening, not just at your hospital, but in this trend around the state.
Well, I think it's analogous to global warming. It's more than one thing going on here. So it's the multiple factors coming together to create a perfect storm. And the storm usually occurs as soon as school opens. Last year, the year before, we had a sustained surge, truly a state of crisis in the emergency room from September all the way through June. The reason is that children are under more stress during the school year, but the school is also a place that catches the children and refers them for mental health crises. If you look nationally, the rate of suicide among youth has increased. So that certainly is not the state's fault. Right? In 2007, you had suicide as the third leading cause of death for teenagers, 15 and older. In 2009, it's now from children 10 years and older as the third leading cause of death. Hmm. So many children coming to the emergency room are children with severe depression, life-threatening attempts at their life. They are also coming in because of neurological complications of illness. We call neuropsychiatric illness, illnesses that cause confusion, make it difficult for them to determine reality from fantasy or reality from psychosis. But some of the children who come and have no place to go are children who traditionally have been children who have barriers to access for care. We've always had children stuck in the emergency room who had those barriers. Those include the children who are at the highest end of need. So ironically, the emergency room, which is the least equipped to deal with the most severe mental illness, is the only place that services those children until we can transfer them to an inpatient level of care.
When you say least equipped, tell us a bit more about that, because mm-hmm. I think many people think of the emergency room as a kind of a one-stop shop for what ails you urgently. No matter what the problem is, you go to an emergency room if indeed this is a life-threatening situation or a situation that is just beyond the ability of someone to understand, control, or wait for a doctor's appointment. So what you're saying is emergency rooms, not just yours, but emergency rooms around the state, around the nation, just aren't equipped to do some of the things that these kids in mental health crisis really need.
That's true, except for the first 6 to 8 hours. Mm-hmm. It is the job of the emergency room for the first 6 to 8 hours to receive that child, to assess them, understand the problem, and you triage, you determine what level of care is needed. Once you have a level of care determined, it should no longer be the job of the emergency room to care for those patients. It's their job now to transfer them to the appropriate level of care. That's where we have a huge breakdown right now.
So as we talk about this issue, and if you want to join us, 860-275-7266, if you have stories of your own about trying to get urgent mental health services for your child, 860-275-7266. One of the things that Lisa Chetical was talking about, and one of the reasons she featured your hospital in this story, was, first of all, you have very accurate numbers. You're able to chart how much this problem has risen over the course of the last number of years. But she also says that there just aren't the beds available. There aren't the places to put these kids for the services. Tell us more about that.
All right. First of all, I have a unique vantage point. So as I'm the sole child psychiatrist in the emergency room that's my day job. So I spend 40-plus hours, usually starting at 6 a.m., 5 days a week, in the emergency room or the medical floors at Connecticut Children's. And I have to say, that is a privilege to be there. My coworkers, the nurses, the physicians, the security staff are incredible. We also do have trained psychiatric clinicians there. They are the clinicians who are trained at Hartford Hospital, Institute of Living, and they serve as consultants together with the child psychiatrist in the emergency room. Part of what has happened is that when children are in the emergency room now and we need access to care, there are so many barriers to that access that my job has now become not just assessing children, but reassessing children, and then trying to get through the red tape of our fragmented system. Our mental health system is so broken at this point that the only thing holding it together seems to be red tape. Mm. One of the problems has been that services have been taken away before adequate services have been up and running.
And when you say adequate services have been taken away, what specifically do you mean?
Well, we no longer have a unit for children under the age of 13 who need longer-term inpatient stabilization.
And this is a state unit, you mean?
That is a state unit. We also lost an adolescent unit at the state level for children who need longer inpatient stay. So, for example, in May of this past year, I would come into 12 to 18 patients who were waiting in the emergency room, many of whom had been waiting for 6 days. Some of those patients were patients who normally have no normal barriers to access, commercial insurance, a clear, understandable illness such as life-threatening depression. They have means for access because there's commercial insurance or Husky insurance, and there are absolutely no beds available for days. So part of my job now when I come in is, first of all, I can tell how bad the surge is as I enter the door into the emergency room. Because as I enter from the door, remember now, an emergency room is unlocked, right? So you enter through a door, and there's usually a towel over the door so it doesn't close shut with a bang, because there are children and parents lined up in the hallway all the way around in the emergency room. Because we have so many, there's only 25 bays there, including, this is a trauma level one hospital.
So I'm just going to stop you, Lynn, and Lisa Chedical. I'm going to ask you a question about this in a second. And before we turn to our other panelists, though, I think, you know, one question maybe a lot of people listening right now would say is, your hospital sees the trends. You see the way things have gone over the course of the last couple of years. Why is it that you are the only person qualified to do what you do, who is there only a certain number of hours a week? You clearly can't see all the kids necessary. There aren't the bays necessary. Should your hospital actually be putting forth some more resources to deal with what is clearly an emergent situation for all of these children?
So now, let me understand the question a little bit better. Should the ship responding to the crisis of other ships that have gone down at sea, and they're absorbing everybody who's adrift in the water, is now responsible for somehow getting more provisions and staff to take care of the crises that's occurring in everybody's waters?
I think that that's the question a lot of people would ask, and so that's why I'm asking you that. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's the state's responsibility. These children who are in such crisis, and their families, right? Children come with families. Their parents are in an equal state of concern or crisis or despair. They are everybody's children. They don't belong to any one hospital or any one service, because oftentimes their need is so great, they have to go across a continuum of services. The continuum of services is not working well right now. Each part of the continuum is doing something other than what they were designed to do. So, for instance, an inpatient unit is designed as a psychiatric intensive care unit, there to help with safety. When the child is safe enough to themselves, safe enough to others, and you have a holding environment to receive that child that is safe enough to them, you're ready to transfer that patient to the next level of care. If you look at any one inpatient unit, you'll find children who are on what's called discharge delay. They've been ready to step down to care. There is no way to step them down because they don't have access to that next level of care.
So let me put that question quickly to Sarah Egan. She's Connecticut's child advocate who's joined us in the program before to talk about some of these issues. And we never seem to have you in to talk about happy issues, unfortunately, no. Sarah Egan, but it's good to see you once again.
Thanks very much.
So Lisa Chedical lays out the problem, and of course, Lynn is just explaining what happens on a day-to-day basis at her hospital. I just asked her a very simple question. I mean, is it the hospital's problem? Should the hospital staff up to make sure that these kids have the mental health needs met? because we know more of them are coming through the emergency room with problems. She says, well, we're doing really the best we can. It really needs to be the state. What do you say?
Well, I agree. I tend to agree with that. And I think that one of the questions we have to look at is why do we have so many children in crisis? Not just how do we manage the crisis at the deepest end, which is, of course, imperative. Because as Dr. Mangini points out very poignantly, I mean, we have children and their parents lined up in the hallways, which is just a tragedy that requires all of our immediate attention to address. But also from a big picture standpoint, we have to look at why do we have so many children there in the first place? Do we have a mental health system that is adequate to prevent children from reaching that level of crisis? And why is it that we have so many children and their parents that aren't able to access care or aren't able to find care until there's a crisis? And I think part of the reality in this state, and I think in a lot of states, you know, many ways in Connecticut, we have certain advances and innovations that a lot of other states don't have. But that should not mask the reality of the problem, which is that we still have a children and family mental health system that is crisis-driven in many ways. If you compare it to the medical system, for example, you know, you go to your doctor, you go every year, you get a wellness check, you look at all the things, you're preventing disease.
And that's increasing. I mean, the whole point of the healthcare overhaul that we had was in part to get people thinking about preventative healthcare, driving down the overall cost, hopefully increasing people's overall health along the way. But you're saying in the mental health system, especially for children, that's just not there.
Well, there are pockets of it that are there. I mean, I think we're increasingly starting to recognize that when you go to your – when a child goes to the pediatrician, we can't just ask about height, weight, head size, et cetera. And, boy, I love pediatricians. I have two little kids. Terrific. But, you know, but that when we're talking about children's wellness, we're talking about family's wellness. We're talking about social-emotional health. We're talking about risk factors for depression and how kids are doing in school. And we still at this point have a mental health system that's compartmentalized from that. We have a mental health system that in many ways, instead of being responsive and supportive, is reactive and crisis-driven, so that parents wind up taking their child to the emergency room when the house is on fire, when the house is falling apart, when they're getting kicked out of school. We still have a mental health system that is based on episodic care. You know, John has a problem right now. Lynn has a problem right now. So we're going to provide treatment. And then help goes away. So instead of I meet with my doctor every 6 months and he says, hey, how you doing? How's school going? How you feeling? How you sleeping? How are you getting along with other kids in the family? That we don't have that on the mental health side. You know, we don't have somebody that sticks with the family in that way.
Does that all sound right to you, Lynn?
Absolutely. Sarah, your point is so well taken, because oftentimes we see children in the emergency room when they are changing a level of care. They just got out of an inpatient unit. They just stepped down from 5 days a week at a group treatment called day treatment, partial hospital program, to 3 days a week. And even that decrease from 5 days to 3 days was too much. Their in-home services, which had done excellent work for 6 months, now has to start terminating services and transfer them down to the next level of care, down to outpatient, and they're unable to tolerate that. There is a percentage of children at every level of care who need longer than what is available, because psychiatric care, mental health care, is based on relationship, right? Every time a child or a parent talks with a physician, a therapist, about their own thoughts and feelings and behavior, that's a courageous act. It's a very difficult thing to do. And then we ask them to go back out into the same stressful situation but cope with it better. It's really an uphill battle for so many children. And I think that, unfortunately, the system sometimes views recurrences, return to the emergency room, return to levels of care, as a failure, as opposed to the services themselves aren't adequate to have met that level of severity of illness.
Before we take our break, I'd like to just bring back in Lisa Chedical from the Connecticut Health Investigative Team, who wrote this story that got us talking about this subject. So, Lisa, we've heard some of the problems laid out here from the hospital end and certainly from Connecticut's child advocate. What's the next thing you're looking at here? What are some of the other issues that you think need to be addressed?
It's interesting, John, because there's a task force that reported out, formed after the Newtown shootings, about young adults' mental health, and their in October, I think, DCF will be presenting a plan to improve children's mental health. And from what I can tell, a lot of the focus in Connecticut at the state level is on screening and identifying the problems. What Sarah talked about, getting them early before they're in crisis, which I, you know, a lot of the proposals that have come up in the last year or so are for schools to do a better job of screening, for pediatricians to screen for mental health. I'm kind of, as a reporter, more interested on the treatment side. I mean, I think it's great to identify the problems as early as we can, but I'm wondering where we're going to get the clinicians to actually treat those problems, because there would appear to be, and I think the panel would agree, an acute shortage of inpatient and outpatient programs in Connecticut. So I think, you know, I'm certainly more interested in what Connecticut does on the treatment side. I think that's going to be much more expensive than the screening side. And I the identification, I think, in a tight budget situation, that getting schools to screen and pediatricians to screen is probably the an attractive route to take. But I'm very interested on the treatment side, and I do agree with Lynn that adding more hospital beds is not going to do it. I mean, you don't want kids warehoused in hospitals for long periods of time. You want them out in community settings getting treatment. So I think it's going to be an interesting debate in Connecticut over the next few months about how we're going to alleviate this ER problem.
Well, we're going to try to hopefully answer some of those questions that you raised. Lisa Chedickle, senior writer and co-founder of the Connecticut Health Investigative Team. Her story, Long ER Stays for Kids in Crisis on the Rise. It obviously talked about not just that issue, but many other things. If you follow us on Twitter at Where We Live, we just sent out a link to that story. Lisa, as always, thank you for your work and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, John.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue and get some more answers from our panel. We've got a tweet from Sarah who says, please, it's not just ER wait times, is trying to get inpatient placement when needed. Sometimes it takes weeks to get a bed, and that's with insurance. And then when you get a kid in, insurance can't wait to get them out. We got another tweet from Nancy. It's been like this in Connecticut for years. A perfect storm of vulnerability, lack of resources, an MD fear of liability and ambiguity. You can keep the tweets coming at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about mental illness and children. We're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Lynn Mangini is a child psychiatrist at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. We're also joined by Sarah Egan, who's Connecticut's child advocate. And we're joined as well in studio by Jeffrey Vanderplug. He's a vice president of mental health initiatives at the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. We'll get to some phone calls in just a moment. Jeff, welcome to our program. I'm wondering if I might have you weigh in on some of what we've heard so far. Essentially, this story that Lisa Chedickle wrote, talking where she was originally looking at long ER wait times for kids who need mental health services, it turns into a much bigger issue where we just once again rip open this idea that Connecticut does not have the mental health services for children that perhaps we need. We talk a lot about barriers to care. What is it you see in here as the biggest problems?
Well, I'm very much in agreement with everything that I'm hearing today from the other panelists. I see a system that I agree that more children are being identified as having mental health needs, that more referrals are coming in from families who are sensitive to what they see going on in their children. And I also agree that schools are increasingly making referrals to emergency departments and contributing to the volume there. I also think that there's a persistent issue of stigma associated with mental illness in this country that comes into play. And I think the way that plays out in the mental health system is that it's uncomfortable for many families to seek care in a mental health clinic. And they know that the emergency department is one of the only places that will not turn them away if they come in for care. And that's where people are accustomed to going to for good care. And that contributes to the issue as well. I also think there's a lack of information among families about what resources are available to them. And so in the absence of having good information and quick and easy access to information about the services that are available, they turn to the emergency department. One thing that has not come up yet today is the role of emergency mobile psychiatric services. And I know from talking to Lynn in the past that they make great use of the EMPS teams in Connecticut. And EMPS is a great resource for helping reduce the number of kids who are in the emergency department for long periods of time. It is also a great resource for diverting kids who are in schools and in homes with their family members who have mental health needs and may otherwise go to the emergency department. And it's a great service that's accessible to any kid who has a mental health need, regardless of their insurance status, regardless of whether they're involved in a system, and regardless of their ability to pay.
We've heard in the past, let's say last few years, a term come up of mental health first aid. Is that sort of what we're talking about here?
The EMPS system, Emergency Mobile Psychiatric Services, is a little bit different than that. It's an actual service that's staffed by mental health clinicians. There are 14 sites across the state, over 150 part-time and full-time clinicians. And the service is accessible by dialing 211. And they will come out to the home, they'll come out to the school, and they'll provide services to the young person. Mental health first aid is another way to increase the amount of information that people have about mental illness, being able to recognize when there's a mental health need, and then having some resources about where to send those children.
Yeah.
I think what happens is, and we started to talk about this point earlier, right now we are already facing a crisis where the level of capacity in the system doesn't meet the need. And I'm fearful of a system where we do more screening without sufficiently expanding access to care. Because if you identify more kids who have potential mental health issues and you don't have the access or the capacity within the system to meet that need, you're going to see an even larger problem.
So we take the problem maybe out of the emergency room. There's more screening happening, but still that next barrier is there.
I agree. I think that we need to build capacity in the community so that the emergency department, as Lynn mentioned, the emergency department is not set up to meet these needs. They're not an ideal treatment system for kids who have mental health issues.
Well, and when I raise this issue, and just very quickly, Lynn, because I want to get to some phone calls, when I raise this issue of mental health first aid, we train many people in this world in some sort of rudimentary first aid because they're primary caregivers. They're police officers. They are people who work at schools. Mental health first aid is something that's not as widely taught. But again, it's maybe an intervention that can be helpful in an early stage in some problem.
Absolutely, in the early stages. However, by the time the children are in the emergency room, you're way beyond that point. We could not do our job without the assistance of Mobile Crisis. It's an excellent service. But we also get many of our referrals from Mobile Crisis because the severity of illness is beyond what their capacity at that point to maintain the child safely in the community. In fact, Wheeler has a Mobile Crisis clinician based with us in the emergency room now to help with the oncoming surge that we're expecting that's beginning actually as we speak. We also have to say have an excellent partnering with the mental health services of Husky. And many people don't realize what advocates they are for children. We've also had a number of innovative programs which have been truly helpful, like the intensive community program that was based at the Village, which was a 4-month residential program. Once that child was stepped down from the residential level of care back to the community level of care, the same treatment team followed that child in the community for up to a year. That service, unfortunately, is no longer available.
This is one of the services that's been recently cut by the State Department of Children and Families. And Sarah Egan, we're going to get back to that in a moment, but I do want to get some phone calls because people want to share some of their stories, including Leslie, who's calling on the line. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I certainly agree with the lack of treatment that's available, and there is a severe crisis with that. My experience with my own child being in a public school system, he's now in a higher level, but when he was in his primary elementary school level, we started seeing some suggestions that perhaps there was going to be some major issues. My feeling is, going back, that if issues can be diagnosed earlier and treatment started earlier, as Dr. Mangini mentioned, before it reaches a crisis, that would be better. For the family, for the child. My child has missed a couple years of his life because of improper treatment, being given medication that had really severe complications. If, you know, my plea is to the educational system to train the teachers and special services people to identify the problems and then start the treatment immediately. So, that's my input. Thanks.
Leslie, thank you very much for the input. I appreciate it, and thank you for your phone call. I want to get to Ted, who's calling from Newtown. Hello, Ted.
Hey, John. How are you? Thanks for getting me on your call here.
Of course.
My concern is the rather excessive drugging of kids and young adults and children, and the results of acting out while they are on medication. So the question that I have for the panelists is, what percentage of all these increases in emergency room mental health issues are from children that are already on a psychiatric medication? And I'll get off the line and listen to the call. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Lynn, do you have a sense of an answer for Ted?
Yes. Well, I would say that many of the children who present to the emergency room are currently in treatment, either with therapy or combined treatment, therapy and medication. However, very small numbers of those children are having behavioral side effects to the medication that's causing the actual crisis at the time. It's usually more the case that the medication and therapy combination is not adequate at that point for treatment.
One of the things that I guess I'm seeing in my mind under this system in which you have people being screened in various ways, getting services to the emergency room, not having long-term care that maybe they need, is this term always comes up, this a fragmented system, one in which there's not a continuum of care. To Ted's point, when you combine a lack of consistent care with very strong medications at times, that I would think, being a layperson, might contribute to some problems, Lynn. The idea is that you have different people prescribing different things to kids across a wide spectrum of ages, ranges. That could, I think, maybe contribute to some of the problems?
I think that certainly could be. It's a valid point. In medicine, you know, our saying is, first, do no harm. That's one of our primary principles. And it's very difficult to manage side effects of medication when children are on multiple medications. You really want for them to use the smallest dose and the smallest amount of medication for the least amount of time. But you also need that child to be stable enough to tolerate those changes. There are many disorders as well for which medication is only, if 25% improvement can be gained with medication, that's a win. Many people don't realize that in psychiatry. So, for instance, the children of deep trauma, the children with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, the children with reactive attachment disorder, the children on the spectrum for autism, the children with developmental disabilities. These are children for whom services don't exist in an ideal state in our state. We do not have, for instance, in any inpatient unit in the state that specializes in children on the spectrum.
Mm. And Jeff, just quickly before I get to another phone call, one thing that makes me think of is again, when we get back to the emergency room as a bellwether for the way this is all working, if you bring your child to the emergency room because he broke his arm, the assumption is that the first thing that happens is that that problem is addressed, and then there's a long-term plan. Maybe it's surgery, maybe it's physical therapy, but there's an expectation that your child is fixed. Almost everything Lynn just said made me feel as though we maybe have the wrong idea about this, because we're not fixing children long term. They're dealing with conditions that they may indeed live with for their entire lives, with medication or without.
I think you're right about that. I think many children require longer term care than what's being made available to them. And I think we, again, must make sure that we have sufficient capacity within the community-based system so that when CCMC or Yale New Haven Hospital is ready to discharge a child who's ready to be discharged into the community, that there are services there to maintain the treatment gains that have been made in the emergency department and to continue to make progress for that child and the family.
Let's go to Mary Jo, who's calling from West Hartford. Mary Jo, are you there?
I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I have a daughter who suffers from really serious mental illness, and our family's actually been very lucky, which may sound strange, but we have excellent private clinicians, excellent pediatrician, excellent teachers. Even with all of private insurance, even with all of that, my daughter still has a seemingly intractable mental illness. And I can't count the number of visits to CCMC, to the emergency department. I mean, I know Dr. Mangini way too well. And we've used DMPS. We've used partial hospitalization, wraparound services, clinical day school. And with all of that, our daughter still struggles to go downhill. And I wanted to just comment on something that Dr. Mangini said and others, which is that there is a percentage of children who need longer and more and a more intensive level of therapeutic care, and that level of care is not available in Connecticut. Our daughter was rejected from every place we applied to that was in that highest level of care in Connecticut, and those places said she needed more intensive therapeutic care than they could provide. So we ended up having to send her out of state to a program that is 24/7 extremely intensive therapeutic, integrated therapeutic program really geared towards her, and she is doing so well. I can't tell you how well she's doing. She's actually now living in an apartment still within the therapeutic milieu, but she's in a transitioning out of that back to real life, living in an apartment, you know, with a job and all. And that was not, that's not available in Connecticut. And it used to be that Department of Children and Families would support a family who had that type of child, that child who really, and it's not most children who have mental illness, but
yes,
it's a small number who needed that higher level of care, and they would help that family by paying on a sliding scale basis a portion of the residential care services. And we went to DCF, and DCF wouldn't even open a file for us. We went to voluntary services.
Well, and what I'm going to do, thank you very much for your phone call. I have to let you go because I want to get a quick comment from Sarah Egan and move on. I am very glad to hear that things are going better for your daughter. That's the most important thing, and I appreciate your phone call. We just got a tweet, Sarah Egan, from CT News Junkie. It's something I've been meaning to say here. They're asking, where is DCF? Why aren't they on this panel? They're the ones writing a report. We've asked the Department of Children and Families to come on this program. They declined to make someone available to us, and so that's why we're talking with the people here. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but I'm wondering, Sarah Egan, if we can just flesh out this a little bit more. I'm going to bring in a few more guests on the phone in just a moment because there's a lot of people who do want to join our conversation. But maybe you can just talk a little bit more about what DCF has traditionally done for people like our most recent caller and what has changed recently.
Well, I think that the caller raises a very important question that in some ways has a complicated answer. I think on the one hand, it speaks to some of the problems that Dr. Mangini is saying, which there are children who have very intensive high-end needs that they can't find resources, that they can't find the type of inpatient bed or inpatient unit that can provide the sort of complex care that they need. I think that's absolutely true. And then simultaneous to that, there are children in inpatient who can't step down because the community doesn't have what they need, which means we have to be doing two things at the same time. We have to ensure access to high quality, multifocal treatment in inpatient settings for kids that need it. And we also have to provide a continuum of high-quality multifocal treatment in the community for kids who don't or shouldn't be in congregate care. And I think in terms of the role of DCF, which I know has gotten a lot of attention lately, I think that where DCF was absolutely correct is that the state for a long time had relied way too heavily on the use of non-family settings for a lot of children, particularly for a lot of children in DCF care who lived in congregate care settings simply because there was no place else to put them. And in fact, it's not too long ago, Connecticut had one of the most disproportionate reliance on the use of group home settings and residential settings for abused and neglected children than most any state in the country. So the effort to right-size the use of congregate care for kids is incredibly important. I think the key is how do we operationalize that? How do we do so with a way that that looks comprehensively at the quality of what we're delivering, the outcomes for children who are both in congregate care and those who have been diverted away? How do we assess the needs of our children so that we have the adequate number of high-end inpatient beds and the right continuum of services in the community. And I think to the extent their questions have been raised in recent days about DCF's policies, to me it's the philosophy is not the issue. The questions are about implementation and quality and how do we make sure we're moving things in the right direction and that kids don't fall through the cracks in the interim.
When we come back from our break, we're going to talk to a state lawmaker who's working on some of these issues. We've got more phone calls to get to at 860-275-7266. We're talking about children's mental health in Connecticut, and this is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, Bill Clinton is coming to Connecticut to raise money for Dan Malloy, and John Roland is going back on trial. Those are some stories we'll be talking about tomorrow in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about children's mental health in the state. There's a lot to talk about, and we have a panel of experts here. I also have on the phone Beth Bai, who's a state senator who works very closely on these issues. She's been listening into this conversation. Senator Bai, welcome back to Where We Live.
Oh, thanks, John. Happy to be here.
I'm wondering quickly if you can address this issue about the Department of Children and Families changing some of its policies. We've heard from a number of panelists and also families saying there just aren't the services necessary. As we get ready for a new legislative session at the end of this year, what are state lawmakers going to do about this?
Well, I think this has been a big concern of ours that we've expressed in a number of public hearings. Representative Walker and I, and we've been talking with DCF and the administration. I agree with Sarah Egan that the big issue is that as we move from non-family settings to more family settings with DCF, and that includes children who are in voluntary services that you heard Mary Jo speak about. So if kids have very severe needs, even if they have parents that are very supportive, they get help from DCF. And as we move toward more family settings, we have to make sure we stage it appropriately. And I think a lot of what we're seeing at the emergency room is because we haven't staged that move appropriately as a state. And so when programs like the program at the Village closed that you heard Dr. Mangini refer to as very effective, and then she has nowhere to refer kids out of the emergency room, I think the pipeline is broken, and some of it is related to state policy, and we are urging DCF to look carefully at the pipeline and make sure we don't close too many options for children and families.
How much can be actually done in legislation? I mean, how much is this an issue that can be solved at the state capitol in Hartford?
Well, I think legislators have an oversight role in terms of the administration, and the reason I'm involved is I have so many families who have been in the emergency room. I've been to the emergency room and seen Dr. Mangini. And Children's is getting one emergency room visit pay of $250, and children are there sometimes 6, 7, 8 days with round-the-clock security guards and all kinds of other help. So we are seeing the crisis on the ground from our constituents, and we are talking to the administration and DCF and saying, please recognize that it's a complicated system with insurance companies and Husky, and DCF has a role, but that we have concerns that the role that DCF is playing right now might be aggravating these problems. I really believe they are. I don't think the commissioner would agree with me. But we need to look at it. And so I think our role is oversight. And if we need legislation, we'll have it. But I believe we'll get collaboration from the administration to make sure we keep options available and help with this problem. We need to stage this appropriately.
Beth Bai is a state senator who works very closely on children's issues. Beth, thank you so much for joining
us.
I appreciate it. We're getting a phone call from a colleague of Lynn Mangini's, Dr. Hank Schwartz from the Institute of Living, someone who's joined us in the program before. Hank, welcome back to our program. What's on your mind?
Hi, John. Thanks. Well, I just want to reiterate what a number of others have said, and that is that the philosophy behind returning kids to families when possible and even foster families and Connecticut's over-reliance on congregate care in the past perhaps is all true. But at the same time, there is a direct relationship between the fact that we're shutting down congregate care programs as we speak and kids are backing up and spending as much as 2 days in the emergency room. The kids go from the emergency room, and by the way, earlier in your program, it was said that CCMC doesn't have inpatient beds. That's true, but CCMC does have a relationship with the Institute of Living, and we have our inpatient unit, which is almost universally filled with the kids who come out of the CCMC beds. And we can't get many of those kids out because the next level of care, which may have been a residential placement or a group home placement, is being shut off, I think, by a dogmatic adherence on the part of the state, and let's say it, the DCF, to the elimination of congregate care, which is going at a pace that is not taking into account the lack of capacity for other kinds of placements. So that's a critical part of this very, very complex problem. But a second issue I wanted to raise.
Very quickly, if you would, sir.
Okay. Inpatient beds, in addition to the state reducing inpatient beds, a number of the hospitals, and there's only a handful of hospitals around the state that have child and adolescent units, have reduced their inpatient beds because the Medicaid rates for inpatient psychiatry are just really tremendously low and do not reimburse for the cost of care. And that, while nobody wants to think of inpatient hospitalization as a solution to the problem, it is an important step in the rescue of kids in crisis.
And we've heard a few times in just the last couple of minutes the amount that hospitals are getting paid for some of these very important services, whether emergent or long-term, it's not very much money. Dr. Hank Schwartz, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you for your phone call.
Thank you.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and so I'd like to get to some more phone calls, but I want to quickly go around the room. Jeff Vanderplug, I'm wondering if you can just leave us with a thought, things that maybe we haven't talked about, other issues that are very important to address in this conversation.
I think to sum up what I'm hearing from many of the callers and in this room is we need a service system that truly matches the need that exists out there. And that need may be inpatient, residential. It may be intensive community-based services. It might be routine outpatient services. So we need to really make sure that the service system that we have meets the needs. I really also believe that we need to de-silo the system that we have. We have to make sure that kids have access to mental health care that's not driven by the type of insurance they have, the type of state system that they might be involved with, or where they happen to live. We need to have a system where all kids who have mental health needs have access to the care that they deserve.
Sarah Egan?
Yeah, I want to stress the two populations of kids that we haven't talked too much about today. One is I want to echo Dr. Mangini's point about children with autism and developmental disabilities who are much, much more likely to cycle in and out of the emergency department, much more likely to have young children who are in desperate need of services in large part because they cannot access services in the community that they need. This is the number one highest cohort of families that call my office for help, telling me that they are at their, quote, wit's end and are desperate for help. I mean, it just cannot be said enough. And we have dramatic system building to do in that area. Dramatic. The other issue we haven't talked about today are kids of color, disproportionately underutilizing community-based services and disproportionately represented in our juvenile justice system. The majority of 14 to 17-year-olds in the adult correctional system, the vast majority are children of color. Mm. The vast majority of those kids have mental health and trauma histories. So important to talk about that.
Lynn Mangini, I'll just give you the last word. We just have about 30 seconds. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That we're not giving up. We will never give up. So hang in there with us and we'll continue doing the very best we can. And I believe that this is a step to help us move forward. And I want to thank you for your interest.
We will stay interested in this, and we want to keep talking about it. I will say we've had an awful lot of people tell us in politics over the course of the last couple of years that we need to do more about mental health for children. And periodically we check in to see what's actually happening. I think this is a really good wake-up call for me. Thank you very much, Lynn Mangini, for joining us. Lynn Mangini is a psychiatrist at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. Jeffrey Vanderplug is Vice President of Mental Health Initiatives at the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. Sarah Egan is Connecticut's Child Advocate. You can continue this conversation online. It's WNPR.org. Our program is produced today by Britt Hill. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.